This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is another podcast of the World Wide Wave on joy.org.au.
Surfing the globe, bringing you news, views, and current affairs for the LGBT community, this is the World Wide Wave.
And good evening and welcome. It is World Wide Waves time, Joy's international news and current affairs show. We're the show that takes you around the globe one country at a time, and doing that tonight in the studio, we have Paul is here.
Good evening.
Damien.
Hi.
And my name is Matt. Now, World AIDS Day has been held on December 1 every year since 1988. It's dedicated to raising awareness of HIV and AIDS while remembering those who have died. Since the first cases of what we now know as AIDS in the early 1980s, globally about 35 million people have died from HIV and AIDS, and even more than that again are currently living with HIV and AIDS. Each year it's a different theme, and this year's theme in Australia is a bit of a warning shot. It is HIV is still here and it's on the move.
What are the added challenges of delivering an HIV prevention programs to migrants and refugees?
What are the barriers and rewards to delivering HIV programs to these new Australians?
And why are international students an important target for HIV messages? To have a look at HIV through a multicultural lens, tonight we are speaking with Alison Quaylo from the Centre for Culture, Ethnicity, Health, which is based here in Melbourne. Alison is the Acting Co-Executive Manager and Stream Leader for Multicultural Health Improvement, which includes the area of HIV.
Worldwide Wrap, LGBT news from around the world, scanning the globe for stories for the diverse gay and lesbian communities from Australia's Joy 94.9. This is the Worldwide Wrap.
And starting off this evening, we are going to Hong Kong. 7,000 people marched in the Hong Kong Pride on Sunday, including their Equal Opportunities Commissioner Chairman. Currently, discrimination legislation only covers race, sex, disability and family status, so many of those attending the march are calling for sexual and gender identity to be pulled into line and included. The chairman said, "I hope that after the march, the government would promise to hold a consultation on the issue, and hopefully by the end of next year, we would have a drafting committee." They're not exactly speeding through this.
No, he was sort of indicating that there were, quote, encouraging signs of progress. So,
despite
one of those code words for, you know, it hasn't gone away.
Yes. I love how it's an achievement that they have a drafting committee.
That's right. We need a committee to do the agenda to talk about what we're going to talk about.
You've got to start somewhere. I mean, something's better than nothing.
That's true.
The marchers wore green to signify that Hong Kong population has already given the green light to the LGBT community, especially when it comes to combating sexual and gender discrimination.
Now, continuing that pride theme across to India now, where last Sunday, the 9th annual Delhi Queer Pride was held. Thousands turned out in very gorgeous sunny weather to witness the event and send a clear message to the government. The message was, if some of us aren't free, no one is. And they are targeting the repeal of Section 377, the old Sodomy Act, which...
Comes
from the Brits. We're blaming
it's
you.
It's my fault. I'm sorry. Yeah.
And it criminalises homosexuality. And if you remember...
This is quite significant because at one stage it had been decriminalised.
In 2009?
But then it was overturned.
In 2013. It's the bouncing penal code.
So whilst there were thousands turning out, and there's some really great photos and a video on our Facebook page, if you go to W3Joy, you can see some of the colour. It's interesting, this is a city of 25 million people. So, you know, thousands or even tens of thousands amongst that size is still quite small. So homosexuality is still quite taboo, and they are fighting very, very hard, but good on them for showing their pride.
Absolutely. And now over to Pakistan, where a group of transgender activists are trying to build a mosque on the outskirts of the capital, Islamabad, where they would be able to pray without falling prey to social stigmas. Now, this isn't quite what you think. It's not actually a religious issue. It's rather a cultural one. Where
I thought you were going to say a money one, actually.
Well, probably building the mosque is.
No, the reason that they're not, they're told they're not allowed in the mosque is cultural. It's not religious. Transgender people in Pakistan at the moment, everything they do is really, they're facing a fight. So that extends from the way they're represented on their national identity cards, census forms, you know, everywhere in society, they're kind of having to fight these social stigmas. Now, combating that is a trans activist group called the Shimal Association for Fundamental Rights, SAFAR, and they're seeking to build this mosque as a safe place for transgender people to offer prayers, and currently working to raise money for the project.
And they're hoping that transgender people will be able to free to join in the congregation at the mosque, especially for Friday prayers, and that the mosque would also serve as a seminary.
And how unholy is this? Currently, trans people who attend regular mosques are frequently the target of insulting comments or mocked by other worshippers. Sometimes they will not permit trans people to even stand outside a mosque and will call the police on them. They're at a mosque. They're meant to be, like, cleansing and being good.
That's not necessarily always the case. So it's this, the Hijra community in the area, there are some places where they are quite revered and accepted and some where it's the exact opposite.
But that's true of quite a few religions. But we won't get onto that now.
We'll get on to Russia instead, where we continue with the news from the trans community, where a first-of-its-kind study conducted in Russia revealed that half of trans people are rejected for jobs based on their gender identity. The study says many employers are concerned about the risk of problems during inspections that might arise in case they hire a transgender person whose appearance does not match their passport data.
What inspections?
So this is clearly about
the
government coming in to check. But, you've got to wonder whether this is a bit of a way of getting around dealing with the issue. Oh, you know, the government's doing it. There's some other worrying statistics there too. 62% of respondents are not applying for jobs due to fear of discrimination, and 41% avoid seeing a doctor or using public health services.
That's horrific. 41% of the trans community is pretty much
avoiding health checks. I guess it would be quite confronting to go into these health services. They've also got these anti-gay propaganda laws, which have, you
Absolutely.
Know, heightened fear, violence, all sorts of things as well.
Whilst it's understandable, the repercussions, though, are somewhat frightening that to, you know, all these people out there that can't access healthcare.
And look, there's hurdles put in their way all the way. So to obtain legal gender recognition in Russia, trans people need a psychiatric evaluation and a medical examination. They need to prove they've undergone hormone replacement therapy. They need to apply to amend their birth records, so paperwork plus there, I'll bet. And then they need to go through and replace all their official documents. Mm. Obviously, there's lots of stress and challenges there for trans people.
In brief, in the US, McDonald's franchises had to pay $103,000 to a former employee who was fired for being HIV positive.
Also in the US, a Texas state senator and Tea Party member has filed legislation that would require teachers and school administration to out their LGBT students to their parents.
And we had lots of comments on that one on Facebook. And the mayor of a Hungarian village has banned openly supporting marriage equality, as well as building mosques and wearing headscarves. And that's a wrap.
That's your Worldwide Wrap. Keep up with LGBT news from around the world throughout the week. Like us on Facebook, Worldwide Wave, or visit joy.org.au/worldwidewave.
Hello, this is Wolfgang from Conchitaburst City, which is Vienna in Austria. You're listening to Worldwide Wave from Joy 94.9.
We've got a message in. Thanks, Ben. Still can't believe that India repealed their anti-gay law and then brought it back a few years later. Neither can we.
I know.
Hope the US doesn't go down the same road with Trump. Thanks for that. Joining us on the line now, we have Alison Coelho from the Centre for Culture, Ethnicity and Health. Welcome, Alison.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. Now, tell us a bit about the work that you do with the health of refugees and migrants coming to Australia.
We work with a number of groups. We work with people from a refugee and migrant background, but we also work with asylum seekers and mobile populations. And when I say mobile populations in Victoria, we usually mean international students. If we're in WA, we'd probably be referring to 457 visa holders. So some of the things that we do is we do a lot of community education, so directly with those communities. We also have a number of community action programs. Some of those programs include the peer education project, and peer education is not unusual in this sector. However, what we do is we train up communities, you know, individuals from a particular community. We work alongside them for approximately just under 12 months, and then they deliver in first language back to their own community. So it's a pretty extraordinary program, and that's been evaluated a couple of times by the Burnett Institute. We also do another program, which is MCAN, which means that the people that have worked alongside us as those peer educators then go into another network alongside faith leaders and other community leaders and other interested parties, such as doctors and other, you know, influential people in their own communities, to devise their own health promotion activities, and we support them to do that. So it's a fabulous program.
Alison, what's the level of HIV knowledge amongst new arrivals?
So it's very interesting and very varied. So depending on where people have come from, often we find that for a lot of people, their health literacy knowledge is quite low. So they might not even realise that HIV causes AIDS, and often they think they've left AIDS behind in their country of origin. So it is quite complicated, especially when we're talking about new treatments or prevention like PrEP, for instance. It makes it quite difficult to discuss these issues with people who don't realise that HIV actually exists in Australia.
That's quite interesting. So they kind of think that they're moving to, you know, quite a developed first world country, so it's kind of not going to be an issue, and you're already working with the incorrect mindset from the get-go.
Yes, absolutely. So so there's a lot of myths that our community engagement officers have to sort of bust before they get into other complex issues. And also, HIV isn't the only issue that we're dealing with. Because MHSS deals with the whole plethora of bloodborne viruses and STIs, co-infection is an issue, especially for humanitarian entrants, that we need to address quite vigorously, as well as issues around, you know, cultural beliefs, health beliefs. Like, people have completely different health belief systems, and they're also coming from a collectivist ideology. And which is quite difficult when you think about the Australian context, where we are working within a neoliberal individual sort of paradigm. So trying to match that up with service delivery is quite complicated, and I think that's what MHSS's strength is, because we straddle both worlds, and we can support people to reach, you know, the best health outcome possible.
Sorry, it's Damien here. I just, forgive me, but if you can clarify what you meant by the collectivist mentality versus individual, and, you know, what does that mean in practical terms?
Okay, so in practical terms, for instance, if you have, so I'll give you an example. If you have an injecting drug user from a collectivist cohort, so that might be, you know, previously maybe in the 90s, we might have a community that was injecting. Part of that collectivism means that you share everything.
Right.
Okay? So that puts you at greater risk. So for instance, if there is an HIV diagnosis, that doesn't just affect that individual. Diagnosis affects the entire family and the community. And so we have sort of layers and compounded levels of stigma that these communities have to address, both internally. So we know that people isolate themselves, and we also know that there can be issues within their own community. They might be ostracised. However, one of the biggest things that our clients say to us is the stigma that they experience when trying to seek help from a mainstream service that does not understand their own health beliefs or how they feel about particular diseases.
And that's in reference to what they experience in Australia?
Yes, absolutely.
Alison, is there at all an upside in that, that if you can, I guess, get within that community and get them to embrace and take ownership, that that will actually help to disseminate messages and help to break down that stigma?
Absolutely. So I mentioned earlier the Multicultural Community Action Network, which is MCAN. They've devised their own little health promotion messages. They filmed them. They've got posters. And they're right throughout the community. And all that is very simple. And it's all in English. The script just says, I'm happy, I know my status. And so then people go and get tested accordingly. So it just really promotes the basic sort of tenets about knowing your status. The only thing is, I guess, what's quite different here is that we have specific services for BBV. Whereas in home country, people are often very used to getting tested on the street outside of church. It's sort of out in the open. And when we have specific services, that can add sort of more layers of that stigma. You know, I'm going to this service, therefore everybody will know that I'm, you know, getting tested. And this is a real problem, especially in regional areas in Victoria. And we know this for every population group, that it is very difficult to enjoy anonymity within that sort of regional context. But there is great work being done there by Search, and a little shout out to Jane and her team who do try to address some of these barriers for people.
Alison, it's Paul here. Just for my knowledge, what's BBB?
Oh, sorry, blood-borne viruses and sexually transmissible infections. So we often find if someone's got HIV, they might have something else as well. And we work with high prevalent communities with hepatitis B in particular. And, you know, adding to the stigma when we think about, you know, even hepatitis C, the epidemic globally is quite different to, the epidemic in this country, which is usually, surrounds people who inject drugs. However, overseas, it is usually, the result of, poor sterilisation in medical equipment and mass vaccinations.
Our guest is Alison Quaylo from the Centre for Culture, Ethnicity and Health. Alison, we're going to come back with you in a minute and talk a bit about the work that you're doing with faith leaders and how things might differ a bit with your international students. This is Worldwide Wave on Joy 94.9.
Hi, I'm Amikon Hovsepian. I work for Pink Armenia and our organisation deals with LGBT issues. Here for the Worldwide Wave.
We are talking all things World AIDS Day, which is this Thursday, the 1st of December, with the theme HIV is still here and it's on the move. And joining us, we have Alison Quaylo from the Centre for Culture, Ethnicity and Health. Now, Alison, in some communities, religion plays a very powerful role in influencing their congregation. Does that pose a problem for you in delivering messages about sex or sexuality?
Well, not really, because what we've done at the centre is embrace that fact that many newly arrived and established communities from multicultural backgrounds really do have a lot of reverence for church and faith. So what we've decided to do is work really closely with some faith leaders, and we started this work at the last big AIDS conference in Melbourne in 2014. So that work has been quite rewarding. We've developed a little fact sheet for faith leaders so that they understand what's going on. And basically, they open the doors for our community workers to go in and then work with their congregations with their blessing. And basically, we use the basic tenets of, compassion and inclusion. And so we've had actually no problem, but we do know that for people who are diagnosed, who leave their faith are ostracised from their churches, that plays a huge role in their mental health and their capacity to sort of heal themselves.
Do you find there's a line in dealing with faith leaders that they won't step behind? And I'm thinking they, in bringing a HIV message or prevention message, they're going to be dealing with, one of the groups would be men who have sex with men.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a reluctance to talk about being gay or to acknowledge somebody who is gay?
Well, you know, initially I suppose the assumption would be yes. However, we went to Sydney with a number of faith leaders, and that forum was organised by AFAO, which is the Australian Federation of AIDS Organisations, very early this year. And that worked out fantastically because what we assumed was going to happen did not happen at all. I think once people sort of hear firsthand of experiences about how much their faith means to them and how much it means to be ostracised, there really is no problem. So the training that we do with faith leaders really does talk about the two things. It talks about HIV and all blood-borne viruses and sexually transmissible infections. So as well as
that personal story that really, you know, makes it real?
Yes, absolutely. These faith leaders were really pushing for their communities to be more inclusive and really understood, above all, it is about faith for them. So we've actually not encountered the issues that we thought we would. Of course, we tread very carefully and respectfully. And I think because we are a service that does that, we're a tiny service that works right across the state, I think that sort of reputation has gone before us. So we're very, very fortunate.
Alison, is the stigma for people living with HIV any better or any worse once they arrive in the Australian community?
The fact that some of them don't know that it is here in the Australian community puts them at greater risk. And I think that the stigma is, like I said, it's not the same sort of stigmas that you would expect necessarily from their faith or their internal sort of thinking. But a lot of the stigma that I know that our communities are experiencing through our work actually happens to be when they engage with a mainstream service here, which is particularly tragic. So really what I'm talking about is institutional racism.
So is the stigma because they've got HIV or is it because they are immigrants or refugees? Or both?
Both.
Or both.
Both. So if you look at the headline news, it's, all Africans have HIV or they're violent or all Vietnamese are injecting drug users. So it those sort of media stereotypes do carry for a really long time and they hold a lot of weight. So we do try to do as much work with the media as we possibly can. But we, like I said, we are a tiny team. We're only, seven people working across the state. So it is quite difficult to be on top of every single thing. And that's why we do so much of our work in partnership with great agencies like Living Positive, VAC and Search, as I mentioned before.
Now, On top of all those things, you also work with international students. How does your approach differ in delivering messages to an international student as compared to, say, a refugee or a migrant?
So we still have the same issues around language. There's still barriers around language, and we can assume with most international students, like refugees and migrants, they haven't had the same level of sexual education that we would expect of young people when they arrive in the country. We are also aware through two research projects that we have done, and you can download those from the website, is that young people often choose Australia because it is the first opportunity that they've been out of the gaze of family and their community to actually explore their sexuality. So in the general population, we would assume in a group, maybe 1 out of 10 might identify as gay, whereas we find with international students, the number is probably double that. So there are significant issues. However, like refugees and migrants, it is at their personal detriment necessarily to come out. So a lot of them do go home to get married. A lot of the people that we do see are married with children. So that's why we struggle with the definition of gay and bisexual men. We use MSM because some of them are not identifying as gay men. So we work, at the level that they identify as, not the label that people would like to put onto them.
Does that sexual awakening, I guess, feed riskier behaviour?
Absolutely. So, and also going back again, that they don't know that HIV actually is here. There have been a number of cases where they young men have been taken advantage of, and you know, been actually told, "No, there is no HIV. We don't use condoms here. We don't need to use condoms. So you're quite safe." And then we have had a HIV notification. So there is a lot of risk in that behaviour, and because there is no health sort of understanding about, you know, how to protect themselves and how at risk they actually are, and also the lack of support that they receive. So we've recently received some money from some funding from DEGIDA, which is, you know, Department of Economic Development, to do a small international student project. And we've also received some money from the Office of Multicultural Affairs to do a project working with LGBTIQ people from multicultural backgrounds. So those two will be overlapping, of course, with international students, because that's the greatest proportion. We know from the notification data from last year with the Kirby Institute, for instance, we're seeing rises in particular communities that we've never seen before in surveillance data. However, there are problems with notification data and the surveillance data we get, because often GPs do not fill out the necessary areas. So, you know, country of birth is not always filled out correctly. What we would like to see at CEH is that we also need to know the ethnicity of people with new notifications, and we'd also not like to know their visa status. That would really support agencies like us to have better data and to ensure that our planning is far more effective to target where we need to target.
Alison, just finally, is Australia, I guess, good at delivering multicultural health and support services compared to other countries?
No.
We've got a way to go.
But we're a multicultural society. Well, we'd have it down pat.
Well, that's right. And this is what's really strange. When you look at the data, again, going back to Kirby, what they've just released, people from multicultural backgrounds represent 65% of late diagnoses in this country. That's pretty startling. And although multicultural communities only represent 5% of the population, they represent 17% of new diagnoses. So it's actually the epidemic in this country is changing significantly. And in Victoria, there is only our service that works in that multicultural space. There is also another service that deals the multicultural HIV service that operates out of the Alfred Hospital, and they work on a counselling type basis, whereas we're located within a community health centre. So we do a whole range of things. We, you know, do one-on-one support. We do the sector development, which is an essential part of what we do, because we are so small. We need to get mainstream agencies on board. We support them to deliver a more culturally competent service. We teach them about what does health literacy actually mean. The responsibility for understanding about someone's health does not reside solely on the individual, yet it's the health practitioner's service that needs to ensure that people understand how to take their medication appropriately.
And the fact that you do that with just 7 people is totally amazing. Alison Coelho from the Centre of Cultural Ethnicity and Health, great work you're doing. We wish you best for World AIDS Day, and thanks for joining us on World Wide Wave.
Fabulous. Thank you so much for having me.
Want to hear more? Find out about LGBT life in over 100 countries. Download free podcasts of this show. Subscribe to iTunes or follow us on Twitter. Visit joy.org.au/worldwidewave.
This is Dede Utomo from Kayana Santara in Surabaya, Indonesia, speaking on World Wide Wave.
We talk all things World AIDS Day 2016, where the theme is HIV is still here and it's on the move. Now, we had a message in from Paulie. Thanks, Paulie. Syphilis is up an incredible percentage, which is very true. I guess quite often when talking HIV, you need to talk about the suite of sexually transmitted infections, because there's lots of links, and the various treatments for HIV don't necessarily, or very rarely, cover sexually transmitted infections.
So, are they still called STIs? I've sort of lost track of what
I think so.
Called.
Okay. Yeah, I think so. That's what we're calling them here anyway. Treatments are very effective, so get yourself tested and treated. Thank you for that, Paulie. Teresa as well has come in. Thanks, Teresa. Really good show tonight. Such an important topic. We agree so too. We were actually talking in the little break there about, is the profile going down? Is there's not as much profile for HIV and AIDS here?
Well, Damien was gobsmacked, but he usually is gobsmacked on this program, that people are turning up in this country and they don't realise that we've got HIV AIDS.
That it is international.
That's half of it. And then the other half is that people here lying to those people that already have the wrong idea and going, no, it really is not a problem.
So, but again, is that because the profile is lower? It was only a few months ago that the HIV groups in Australia, the lead ones, said that AIDS was over in Australia. HIV wasn't, but AIDS was over. So have we actually confused people? Are people thinking a bit differently about HIV?
I assume in the general public that HIV and AIDS are the same thing. So if you say one is over, then they will assume the other one is over.
I would hope not, though.
But I would say that's a fair call there, Paul, that people would lump the two in the same bucket and really confuse that message.
Everyone except those who listen to Joy 94.9, because they are very well educated and on the money people. Did want to mention, though, so this Thursday, World AIDS Day, lots of activities on here in Melbourne. So there's an official ceremony and launch at 9 a.m. With the Victorian Minister for Health, the Honourable Jill Hennessy, and that is being held down at the Alfred, the AMREP Lecture Theatre, from 9 a.m. You do need to RSVP, but it is free. So just go to worldaidsday.com.au to RSVP for that one. Another really fascinating, and there's usually a forum, and this year's one is called HIV Then and Now, No One Left Behind. Ro Allen, the Victorian Commissioner for Gender and Sexuality, affectionately known as the Commish. Ro is bringing together a group of people, very high-profile people. Bruce Parnell's in there, who we've had on the show before. Joel Murray, Jeremy Wiggins, Heather Mugwagra. I think I've got that wrong. Sorry, Heather, from Positive Women Victoria. So really interesting panel. That's 11 a.m. Again, down there at the Alfred's AMREP Lecture Theatre.
Then at 6 p.m. is the memorial service. This is at the Positive Living Centre, so that's 51 Commercial Road. And it's a service to commemorate friends and relatives that have died as a result of HIV or AIDS.
And indeed, that's the two sides of World AIDS Day, the education, but also the remembering the, you know, a whole generation of not just gay or LGBT people who died. This has been a worldwide impact. So the place to find out information about all these events is worldaidsday.org.au, and we'll post that link on our Facebook page, W3Joy.
You're on Worldwide Wave on Joy 94.9.
Receive LGBT news from around the world throughout the week. Like Worldwide Wave on Facebook now.
And a big thank you to Alison Coelho from the Centre for Culture, Ethnicity and Health. You can find out about their good work at ceh.org.au and all the World AIDS Day events at worldaidsday.org.au. And taking us out,
every time we say goodbye.
And we'll say goodbye and catch you next week on Worldwide Wave.
Thank you for listening to the Worldwide Wave podcast. We're always looking for interested guests and news tips. You can email us at worldwidewave@joy.org.au.
Australia's most amazing gay and lesbian radio station, Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.